From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me this week, as always, from his overground lair in the beautiful country of Italy, is my man Roger Mitchell. Roger, come in.
Good afternoon, Grant. How are you? Good morning, actually.
Yeah, well, a bit of each, I guess. I'm well, mate. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm enjoying the nice weather here in Lake Como and getting out regularly enough to be having a nice time of it, enjoying life. Life is smiling on me.
Well, that's nice. That's nice to hear. I'm delighted to hear that. Although I have to say, judging from your Twitter feed the other day, you into every life a little rain must fall, I think they say, Ross, don't they? So you were out making friends again.
Well, listen, let's briefly deal with this seriously, then have a laugh.
No, I'd want to do both.
Right. Well, we've talked a lot with Jim Kerr about Black Lives Matter. We don't like hashtags, or certainly I don't. I don't think anybody's in any doubt what we believe about the truth about making the world a better place.
Well, this is important, right? You say I don't think anybody's in any doubt. Anybody who's listened to it, which is the important thing.
Yeah, but anybody right? that's seen me at all in the last 25
right.
years.
Absolutely right.
I mean, I'm not going to be judged on one tweet after being 56 years of age. Exactly. it doesn't even merit that comment. The thing that I would say, Grant, is this, and I'm going to link it to something that at one point was going to be an own goal of mine, but we never got round to it, or I never got round to it. Everybody, as Jim Kerr said, risks not walking the talk in this area. And there's a whole world of hypocrisy. So I'm going to refer you to that famous Nike commercial. You know the one I'm talking about, the one that everybody got so dewy-eyed about, with the double screen where one fades into the other one. You saw that one recently.
Yeah, just the split screen.
Split screen. And isn't this lovely? Well, this is wonderful, isn't it? You know, for me, that was bullshit from the start, because this is an organization no different from anybody else. I'm not giving them a hard time, but, you know, they live in a world which, and they work in a world which is harder than the image that they portray and things like that. This is the world of Salazar, drugs, and everything that Nike has been involved in recently. But that's not enough. They put out this video, and what happens? Their black employees say, oh, that's all very nice of you doing that, but how about treating us fairly, something you've never done in the last X years? So since I know that's how the world works, I've been around long enough to know that there is sugar-coated gloss and then there's the reality. I have very little time for virtue signaling, very little. And I certainly won't be bullied into it by hashtags and peer pressure. So what happens the other night? Now, you and I know football fans. We've been around them long enough. And I'll give you this example. Football fans are funny. You know, I'll give you this example. A Celtic player, maybe I've said this before, maybe I've not. Celtic player in the 90s, Darren Jackson, had a very bad illness, something to do with water on the brain. I don't know, I'm not an expert. He was out for basically a whole season. And I was at the game that he came back at Celtic Park. And, you know, the announcer on the tannoy, welcome back, one of our favourite sons, Darren Jackson, give him a big warm Celtic Park welcome. Standing ovation type thing, you know, because the guy apparently was in death's door. Standing ovation. He comes on as a substitute. First touch is the first touch of somebody that hasn't played for a year, i.e. the second touch was a tackle. Second time he gets the ball, again, loses it. And everybody's saying, oh, come on, you know, like, don't worry, you know, come on, Darren, come on, back in it now. You know, the pass behind you. Third time he makes a really bad pass. And the fans, you know, immediately one to each other. This cunt has been taking a wage from us for a year and has done fuck all. You know, like, and this is in the space of 5 minutes, Grant. So I'm watching Sterling make that error. And I know what fans are thinking. You know, I'm not going to say it here because I can't be bothered with the hassle. But I know what they're thinking. It's about him being down on a knee when he should be practicing putting the ball in front of an empty net. You know, that doesn't change who I am. It doesn't change the reality of it. It's a joke. It's a football joke. And that's how I see it, mate.
No, it's interesting because I kind of saw the backlash and had to follow it backwards to the original tweet. I see a few people having a pop in. I'm thinking, oh Christ, what's he done now? And of course I go back to the original tweet, and I know you and I know what you were saying. I know where it came from, and it just made me laugh, right? Because I know you. But what's so sad is that the outrage reaction from people who don't know where it comes from. You know, the immediate assumption of outrage, right? It's you see a comment which, I mean, I can look at it and go, okay, I know why they're getting upset about that, but why is your instant assumption that this guy's a bad guy? Why isn't it just, oh, you know what, that joke didn't land? You know what I mean? It's so strange to me that the world we live in, the immediate jump is always to, this guy's a bad guy, this is outrageous, it's disgraceful. But something that happened later, and I wanted to get the story from this to you, because I just saw some reference to it about someone apparently claiming to have emailed your employer to try and get you fired. But so run me through that. But seeing as your employer is your dear lady wife.
Yes, that's right. Well, you know, that's their playbook. You know, when they get on the sniff of blood, this is cancel culture, Grant. This is cancel culture. They will go to anybody that you associate with and shame them into making them alienate themselves from you.
Yeah.
So the way they will do it is immediately, first of all, the employer, which obviously in this case is me, is, as you say, Raffaella. And, you know, that they run into a brick wall there. But more than that, you know, I saw people, you know, my website, our website's maybe 10 pages deep of various stuff and quite detailed articles and things like that. People had trawled through all of them to find stuff that they could use.
Yeah.
And one of the comments was, you know, when we were explaining where Raphael and I have come from, we refer to our previous experience, you know, and in the website it cites Napster, which obviously is the music industry, and it cites Marlboro Man, which is when Raphael worked for Philip Morris and led that whole campaign. And, you know, the comment was, well, what do you expect from people who still refer to these things as relevant? You know, so there's a whole ageist thing in there, Grant, that is deeply, deeply worrying. You know, like, it's you know, the whole thing, you know me, Grant, this doesn't bother me at all. It doesn't bother me at all. And like I as I wrote in a tweet thread about a month ago, what these people don't understand is there's a lot of folk like me who will dig their heels in, even when they are the ones that would instinctively push for things to change. You know, we're all in favor of equality and diversity. But if somebody says I need to do it, I'm just going to be obtuse, because it's called backbone, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, at least that's how I am. So, you know, the whole...
No, it's just, you know, it's interesting, right? I mean, it's such a sad indictment on the way the world is going, unfortunately. Not just this, you know, this rush to be offended and demand satisfaction because you've been offended. And the ability of anybody to assume that a joke that they didn't find funny was a joke and not offensive, right? It's impossible for anyone to not find a joke funny anymore. If a joke isn't funny, it's offensive, which is which is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
So anyway. I just wanted to ask you about that because I was sitting quietly amused by the whole thing yesterday, watching the water run off the duck's back while all these people are getting all upset about it.
There may be further consequences for that, you know, because that's how the world
might be.
Works.
But again, you'll be true to yourself, and if there are any more consequences, you'll own them and just say fine, just do your thing. Anyway, let's get to the business of the day, which is goal. As I tend to do, unless I've got something I'm desperate for you not to steal, I'm going to let you go first.
Well, the first one was one that we were going to mention with Hugh Henry, but that goal on goal episode, I think, took its own route and was beautiful because of that. So the goal I'm going to mention is Iggy Pop promoting and being the cheerleader for Detroit FC Soccer Club, football club in the States. And the beautiful voiceover video he did for, I think it's a crowdfunding campaign. And just the idea that this guy, and I don't know how many people know who Iggy Pop is or who he represents. And
I think our demographic, most of them, Rog.
Yeah, well, that's the point. And you know, that's why I wanted to bring it up, because in this world of, what can we call it, fugazi, fake, here today, gone tomorrow, cool, uncool, as you always say, Grant. Iggy Pop is the real deal. You know, I mean, the real deal from hanging out with Bowie in Berlin while he's getting off heroin to, you know, that wonderful story that people should look up about the journey that his leopard jacket took around the world as it ended up in people's hands and bidders tried to get hold of it, so much so that it's almost called the Shroud of Turin now. You know, Iggy Pop is utterly authentic. And the idea that he feels so passionate about a sport that is not one of the main sports in America and from his hometown of Detroit, it's wonderful. You know, if they get that club going and get it off the ground, then that's my team in the MLS.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because MLS, there's so much inauthenticity about it, particularly for guys like us who've grown up, you know, in the home of football. There's so much pizzazz and so much sparkle and glitter and stuff dumped on top of the football, at the moment, the football product itself is inferior. It just is. I mean, that's just the truth, unfortunately. You know, I've been fortunate enough to go to see a few games of Atlanta United with some friends, and as I said, I think we discussed this on the podcast before, that the experience is wonderful. I mean, the fans are amazing. Yeah, the stadium is incredible. The experience is wonderful, but the actual product on the pitch was awful. I mean, the quality of the football was, you know, Division Two. I mean, currently, well, Sky Bet League Two, whatever it is. I mean, it's really not great.
I'm not sure it's any. Well, I'm pretty sure it is better than the SPFL, Grant. And I'm not saying that as a go at them. I think the standard's a bit better than people. I take your point, but it isn't that far off. That's what I think.
No, look, I guess most of it is, it seems incongruous that you've got this amount of pizzazz and fuss around a level of product that is where it is. If you didn't have all the pizzazz, I'm sure the product would feel better, but there's so much fuss made about it that you feel like the football should be better. It's the only thing that lets the experience down is the quality of the football. It's basically it. If you just watched a game in America in a stadium, you know, a small stadium, like, you know, Luton Town Stadium or something like that, it would be perfectly acceptable. But it's a Premier League experience, and it's, you know, Division Two quality football.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a disconnect between the two, which to me is the inauthenticity of it. It's not... The football is the football, but they're trying to create through the experience something that it isn't. And you can go either way with that. I say I thoroughly enjoyed the games I went to, really enjoyed them. But I was, the whole time I was looking at it, and I made the conscious judgment of, well, you know, I'm not here for the football. The football is not going to be great quality, but I'm here for the experience. And it was great.
Yeah, you know, but I think in general, Grant, I know you're like this, and you're slightly different to me on this, that, you know, American sport is not like European sport. It is about the entertainment value. If not, how do you explain professional wrestling and all the other entertainment experiences that they put the sport label on? And that's what I think the difference is. You know, if you go to watch, as Dear Kelvin said, Scunthorpe United, you know, you ain't getting entertained. You know, you're going there because your dad went there. You've got some kind of like historical family allegiance.
Right, authentic. Well, exactly.
Well, again, this is the kernel of the theme of this podcast, but we won't go into it today. But it's, I just think that bringing Iggy into that whole environment of entertainment and experience, I just think that's a great news for the MLS, and that's my goal of the week.
All right, well, I'll let you have that one. It's an own goal and a goal at the same time, and that was the Barcelona Bayern game during the week. You know, it's an utter embarrassment for Barcelona fans, for the players, for the club. I mean, for Barcelona to lose 8-2 in 90 minutes is just shocking. I mean, the era that we've grown up in, that was an unthinkable result. I mean, them turning someone over 8-2, perfectly plausible. But, you know, you've been talking about this Barcelona dynasty coming to an end, and it looked like that when Liverpool beat them 4-0 last year, that I suspect was the biggest warning sign, because Barcelona don't give up a four-goal lead. But this was abject. I mean, Messi looked like he wasn't interested. Looked like he was he's mentally checked out. The quality of the Barcelona defending was shocking. The goalkeeper, Ter Stegen, was just appalling.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the own goal side of it. And the goal side of it, Bayern were just, I mean, okay, Barcelona made them look probably a little bit better than they were, but what a fantastic team. What a great performance. They didn't let up from the first whistle to the last. And they just pummeled Barca. It was definitely the end of an era, and it was definitely a sign that a lot of things will change after that game, I suspect. You know, including Messi, I would guess, leaving Barcelona. I know he's out of contract next year. I would think he'll leave Barca after that. Where he goes, obviously, that will be an interesting thing to watch. And what people will get, whoever buys him, what they will get from Messi at this stage in his career is also up for grabs. I don't know. But what, you watched that game. What did you think of it?
Well, we kind of like watched it together and texted each other. And, you know, after the first 5 minutes, I think I said to you, look, they're going to get a horsing here, like Brazil, Germany, World Cup. And this will be the end of the year, but it's been coming for a while. I would say this about things that people younger than us, Grant, don't realise. Barcelona weren't always the Barcelona of Guardiola. And
no, they weren't.
Right. In the football that I grew up with, our own Dundee United, who were, as we heard in the podcast with Duncan Castles, a superb team, beat them home and away, and Barcelona were not one of the giants of European football. They were a good team that if you got them at home on a good day, they would beat you, but they were never candidates to win the big prizes until recent years. They came up with,
I think Terry Venables might and Bobby Robson might have a few words to say about that.
Well, yeah, but you know what I mean. Like, what happened to make Barcelona what the era that opened was with Cruyff, the academy, the culture of playing a certain way, which Guardiola experienced as a player, and then took in and maximised it with the lucky timing of the golden generation that had come through that academy. And, you know, bit by bit, they lost them. They lost Xavi, they lost Iniesta, they lost Puyol, who I think many people would realise and recognise probably was more important than Piqué, who's been a decent player, but I think the real star there and the captain was Puyol. They lost him. And so much of it was carried, you know, covered up by the genius that is Messi. But all of us in football have looked for 4 years now about the dealings that they've had in the transfer market, the most absurd transfers in and out, huge agent fees, no clear plan. You know, the way they played, the style of football that Guardiola developed, the very high pressing style and the tiki-taki, it's been 3, 4, 5, even maybe more years that that hasn't been the case. It's been a very disjointed team that's been a hybrid of all of those things. And this was coming, you know, and in the back, you've got what is always the case, Grant. And I think this is, you know, we discussed this. You asked me once on another podcast, what makes a great team? What makes a great team is great leadership, great ownership, stability, you know, that you see in a place like Atalanta, you know, where the ownership is clear and strong and empowers the football department to play in a certain way and gets the right coach and everything like that. Barcelona is in the middle of a political fight for years between the presidents and is the complete antithesis of stability. So I actually think they would have been better off having had this denouement 2 or 3 years ago, because I think I agree with you. I think Messi will leave now, most likely go to Inter Milan, and he will leave behind a plethora of debts that they will find difficult to repay, a downgrading of the academy and the players that came from that, no distinctive style of play, all at the time when the football world has gone into recession. And, you know, I'll just say two words to Barcelona fans listening. AC Milan, that's your future.
Well, that's not very encouraging for Barcelona fans. Yeah, it was interesting to see, obviously, Coutinho, they paid Liverpool, what, £100 million for?
Dembele.
Dembele on the bench. You know, they let Neymar go. What did they sell Neymar for? $250 million or something ridiculous?
Yeah, yeah. If you include agents' fees, it's probably right up there, yeah.
You know, I mean, this is money that clearly wasn't spent well or wasn't spent at all. But there's obviously a boatload of very poor decisions been made at that club. And, you know, I guess there's the president will be unelected and, you know, there's all the political shenanigans that are going behind the scenes. But it's just one of those things that it just felt like the end of an era.
Yeah.
Just watching it, you know, you could just feel it in the air. It was like, yeah, their time's done. And look, what an era it was. I mean, the football they played was truly spectacular. But I think that's over, and it happened fast, and it happened in front of everybody's eyes.
Yeah, yeah, and as I say, this isn't the right time for a football club to be at the trough as opposed to on the upswing, because you know you saw.
No, you're right.
You know, you saw in places like Arsenal, you know, with the redundancies. These are going to be tough times for football. And if you don't have that stability and that, let's say, consolidated asset base that can get you through without too much more investment, then I think you're in serious trouble. AC Milan have proved that. And I think it's just going to get a lot worse. So end of an era. I would just like to remember I can't remember the year it was, but the final Barcelona-Man United, the Champions League, which is, I still think, the definitive performance of football. But, you know, Xavi, Iniesta and Messi aren't there anymore.
No, very true. All right, what else you got for me?
Well, do you know what? I'm really getting into Formula One, Grant.
Ah, okay, yeah, okay.
You know, the Drive to Survive series, I think, has been a massive success in terms of marketing. You know, because I'm starting to look at the practice sessions. I'm starting to look at what they call the midfield, because I know some of the backstories, whether it's the Stroll family, whether it's Haas, McLaren coming back, you know, Red Bull, maybe not McCall midfield, but you know what I mean. And it's super interesting. And we've had some great races this year. Sunday's yesterday was not great, but that's not the reason I'm giving it an own goal this week. I'm giving it an own goal because they're ripping each other apart, these teams. And, you know, I'm referring specifically to Racing Point, which is the new name for Stroll's team, which is being accused pretty much of being Mercedes Mark II. The accusation is that Mercedes is passing them key parts, whether it's brake ducts or whatever. It's basically a Mercedes that they are driving, and obviously because of that is a very, very successful car. All the other teams complained. The FIA upheld the complaint, but the penalty wasn't enough for those teams that are feeling really, really raw about this. So, you know, you've got Formula One, which is in the middle of all these new financial budget regulations, which we talked about the last groundsman, which is all good. You've got heightened much new interest for the sport. You've got some really interesting young drivers coming around. And in the background, you've got politics coming out the ears. But, you know, Grant, I think it's inevitable. And this is one of the things that's good about Formula One, or at least for me. For me, it's unadulterated masculine testosterone. And that goes into the back teams as well. You sit looking at Toto Wolff, you know, coming back to the very start of our podcast, I don't think he's Mr. Understanding and flexible. This guy is a hardball, whatever it takes guy, and all of them are right on an edge in terms of testosterone. You just need to look at the first curve. You know, the first turn of the race, you know, guys like Verstappen, all of these people, you know, when you hear them on the radio shouting about the people that get in their way, the gloriousness of unadulterated fuck you competitiveness, I think that's what F1 really needs to build on.
Yeah, it's funny. Since Drive to Survive, I've found myself watching a lot more F1. And I hadn't for years, simply because it just seemed whoever was in the lead at turn one most of the time would win the Grand Prix. And obviously, the quality of Lewis Hamilton's driving makes a lot of these Grand Prix kind of more interesting, the fight for third and fourth place and eighth and ninth place, than it does the lead, because Hamilton is so far ahead, both his driving ability and his car. But no, I agree, and it just shows you what these Amazon/Netflix documentaries that take you behind the scenes do for a sport, because you know you connect with the people, you connect with the characters. You know, Alex Albon's the perfect example, right? You saw him in Drive to Survive, this young kid,
yeah,
great kid, and you know, when I'm seeing him now, I'm connecting with that. I remember seeing him, I remember thinking what a you know, fine young man he was,
yeah.
And you pull for him. And it makes a huge difference in understanding the dynamics, knowing these as real
difference.
People and not, because generally speaking, and if you don't know the characters, you're just looking at the cars,
yeah.
Right? You're just looking at the car and they all look the same, and they, you know, some of them are faster than others. So I agree with you. I don't know about the own goal, but for me, Formula One, you know, I used to watch it a lot more as a kid. And I haven't watched it for years, but I found myself the last 2 years watching a lot more of it and actually getting into really enjoying it again. But I think a huge part of that is my knowledge of the characters and the rivalries and the, you know, the backstories involved. It makes a massive difference.
And that's, you know, one of the big themes we've always talked about here, that sport isn't going to have a great future if it can't work significantly more on the personalities of the protagonists. Significantly,
yeah,
more.
Right.
Exactly. And you know, on that theme, how excited are you about All or Nothing and Jose Mourinho and Spurs? Isn't that going to be amazing?
I think that's going to be really, really interesting. A lot of fun to watch. You know, you've got some great characters there. You've got a season like no other that they've chronicled, which is which is fortunate and unfortunate, I suspect. I think it's going to be a really, really good. That comes out 31st of August, I think, isn't it, Roger?
Yeah, yeah, very soon now. Yeah. Looking forward to that. So what else have you got?
Well, so I've got an own goal, and which is also which turns into a goal, and I'm going to spend the rest of this podcast talking about golf, I suspect, because there's been so much golf and so many interesting things coming out of it. And the first one is the own goal. I was watching the US Amateur Championship, which is as grueling a competition as you can possibly imagine. I mean, these guys play golf on the same course for a week straight. I mean, it's brutal. Two rounds of stroke play determine, you know, your kind of place in the match play brackets, your rank, your seedings, and then it's match play all the way to the 36 hole final, on which happened yesterday. It's a glorious event. It's got everything. It's got all the drama you would want. And in the quarterfinals, a guy called Tyler Strafacci, who his grandfather had won a couple of USGA events back in the 1930s. There's a lot of family pedigree there. He was in a tremendous match with a young Argentine golfer, Oliver Pinto. And the match was on the 18th hole. It was all tied up. It was basically a one-hole playoff. The Argentine hits his second into the greenside bunker, at which point the fun begins. You know, his caddy, who was a local caddy that the guy had picked up when he got to the course. Now, the course was Bandon Dunes out in Bend, Oregon. And for any golfers listening, if you haven't played there and you ever get the chance to go, it is truly, truly as close to golfing heaven as you'll find. It's magnificent. But this guy it was his first year caddying at Bandon. And this young kid had picked him up as a caddy. He's in the bunker, and because the wind was howling, and the wind was howling, Roger, I mean, 35, 40 mile an hour winds every day. It was extraordinary. A lot of the sand had been blown out of the bunker, so it was kind of hard pan in there. And the caddy steps into the bunker, bends down, and is kind of brushing the sand with his hands to test how much sand is in there, which is you're just not allowed to do.
No.
It's a clear infraction. There's a big fuss about it, and they've got the Goodyear blimp, or whatever, they've got the aerial shots, and it's clear what's happened. It's absolutely crystal clear. The guy's gone in, tested the sand, and that in match play is loss of hole, which means the loss of the match. So this Argentine kid, he's in his 20s. The referee's called over. They discuss what's happened, it's all mic'd up. You hear them all, and the referee says, "Look, I'm sorry, you tested the sand. That's loss of hole. The match was tied, therefore you win." And you know, there's the own goal. The own goal is the caddy doing that, right? And here's where the goals start coming thick and fast. Strafacci, you could see how upset he was at winning it that way. He said to the referee, "Are you sure it's not just a one-stroke penalty? Did it have to be loss of hole?" You know, he desperately didn't want to win that way. And the referee's like, "No, I'm sorry, it's loss of hole, you win." You know, he was apologetic to the guy when you know, they shook hands or bumped fist or elbows, whatever it was at the end of it. And was so magnanimous in victory, you could tell that this was painful for him to do. And then, you know, they interviewed the guy, the Argentine guy, Oliver Pinto, afterwards. And, you know, here's a guy who has just been robbed of a potential place in the semifinal of arguably the biggest amateur event in golf by something that had nothing to do with him. A caddy did something that cost him his place in that semifinal potentially. And, you know, a remarkable interview, just composed.
Really?
It was everything that golf is about, right? It was extraordinary to see. You know, he said, "Look, you know, it's not the caddy's fault. I don't blame him. These things happen. Blah blah blah." Now, and it doesn't matter if he wasn't thinking that. He may have been thinking all kinds of things, but the composure this guy showed was just absolutely extraordinary. I mean, the sad thing is, you know, everybody came out of that with credit. It was an incredibly unfortunate situation, a real shame, and everybody involved handled it beautifully. They handled their part of it. They handled their interaction with everybody else, from the referee to the players to the caddy of the Strafalchi, who was his father. It was sportsmanship. Wow. It was competition of the highest order. It was remarkable. And you know, that was just one of the things that golf has thrown up in the last couple of weeks, which I think are worthy of talking about. So that was my own goal, which turned into, you know, it was Barcelona. It was one own goal and eight goals going in. It was yeah. Fantastic.
May I ask you about that a little bit, Grant? The referee, does he not get any power?
No. There's rules. That is right. If you touch the sand in a match play event, it's loss of hold. End of. That's it.
Okay. So is the opponent then, you know, is he not able to
no.
just? Oh, come
nope.
on, Grant.
It's not like American football. You can decline the penalty.
Well, that's an error. Then that's an error for the sport of golf.
I mean, there are so many rules like that in golf, Rog.
Well, there's a mistake,
rules
mate.
Rules that people, like, you're not allowed to repair a spike mark. They've changed that now after 100 years. Look, it may be a mistake, but Rog, that's the point, right? The point is that your Pinto could have railed and said, this is a ridiculous rule. How can I possibly, you know, he could have done that. But the respect for the game and the respect for the rules, whether they're right or wrong, those are the rules of the game. And you respect the rule. You know, there's something about golf. And I've talked about the great, you know, Bobby Jones story before, when he called a penalty on himself when his ball moved after he'd addressed it, and which no one in the world had seen except him. And he called a penalty on himself, which cost him a match. And the press said to him afterwards, you know, why would you it's such an amazing thing you did, calling a penalty on yourself when no one else could do it. And his words were, you may as well praise somebody for not robbing a bank, which is exactly it.
No,
right?
I get respect of the rules. I get respect of the rules, but there should be an overriding rule, which is if I'm the beneficiary of that, I should be able to decline my benefit. That's true sportsmanship, Grant. You know,
I don't disagree, Roger. I don't disagree, but that isn't the case. Whether
well,
it should
need
be
to change
is
it.
A
they
debate
need to
for
change that.
Well, possibly, but rule changes in golf take. Measured in centuries rather than months.
Well, you see, can I link this a little bit to something? I know you may be going to continue.
Do whatever
there,
you want. It's your podcast.
Well, it's not. It's ours. the thing about inflexibility, one of the things that I think this season we'll look back on all over the world regarding VAR is how much the referee on the playing field now has abdicated his role.
Totally.
Well, that's a mistake. You know,
but it was always going to happen.
The record will show that we said that. But I do not like it. It's a little bit linking it back to the start of the thing. It's awful easy to go along with what is the process in life, you know? The real people that make differences are the ones that are prepared to stand up and say, well, I know that I should be doing this, but actually that handball that VAR said is a penalty in the game of football I grew up with, none of the guys, you know, around the playing field would have called for that. None of them. So I'm not giving it. You know, I believe that there is a premium on humans saying, no, this is the right way, regardless of what the tech and what the process says.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you, but as soon as you have the ability to be tried live, you know what's going to happen, right? You know what's going to happen. You know, no one's going to take that chance when the evidence is... Yeah, it is, but that's progress for you, right? That's progress for you. Now, go on. What else have you got? Because I've got a couple more golf ones to bring up, but it's your turn.
Well, okay. I'll throw in a very quick one just to lighten the mood a little bit. We talked about great content before with the documentaries. Did you see the quote by Robin van Persie on his return to Feyenoord? Did you see that?
I didn't. No.
You know, he's been reunited with the coach there of Feyenoord, Dick Advocaat.
Okay.
You know, a famous Dutch coach who's been around Europe for a lot of, and had Robin early in his career. The headline for the article is Robin van Persie returns to Feyenoord saying, I can't say no to Dick. With a big photo of him underneath.
Okay. Well, that's marvellous. Well done. Second language problems, I guess.
Very funny. Very funny. Off you go then with more golf. Well, I love your golf ones because they're so heartfelt.
Well, the PGA Championship last week in San Francisco threw up a young man who I suspect is going to be a major star in the world of golf for many years to come. That's Colin Morikawa. You know, he's quietly taken the golf world by storm. You know, he turned pro, and I think he made his first 20 something cuts, which is an extraordinary achievement on its own. He'd won a couple of times. And then, you know, he gets to the PGA Championship and wins it. But the nature of his victory, particularly his tee shot on 16, you know, a par four where he just hit the most perfect drive under pressure you can imagine. I mean, they will be showing that shot for years and years to come. And it's such a shame that the galleries weren't packed with fans there, because that would have been quite a moment, I think. I mean, it's interesting to wonder what difference not having the fans there makes to some of these golfers. You know, Paul Casey was talking about the fact that he really misses having the fans there and the energy they bring to it.
Okay.
But I suspect for others, it reduces the pressure on them considerably. So, but that's a conversation for another day. But, you know, Morikawa, again, just a great kid, right?
It looks the real deal.
He's got a smile on his face. He's a tremendous golfer. He's a very composed young man. He's authentic. You know, I don't know if you saw the trophy when he lifted the trophy and dropped the lid off it.
Yeah.
You know, the look on his face and the smile afterwards, it was all real, right? All of it was real. There was none of the kind of, he wasn't thinking about sponsors. He wasn't thinking about this. He was a young kid who just made one of his dreams come true. And again, just composed, articulate, erudite. It was fantastic to watch. You know, it was a great championship. And funnily enough, you know, it's been 2 months, I guess, since sport returned, and I'm getting used to not having the fans there now, particularly in golf. It's harder in football because you see them so much more. In every shot, you would see the crowd and you'd hear that noise. And even though they're getting better with the fake fan noises, it's still not the same. But you know, the golf, yes, you miss the fans, but it's funny. A lot of the time you're seeing the shot and then you're seeing the, you know, shot of a golf ball in the air with no fans behind it, and you'll see all you miss is the noise, but you can still watch the golf. So, I just thought watching Morikawa, I thought, you know, this kid is going to be around for years to come, and I suspect he's going to do some great things. I certainly hope so.
No, it was wonderful. And, you know, before leaving that, I'd just like to, you mentioned Paul Casey there.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not into golf the way you are in terms of following everybody, but correct me if I'm wrong, there was a period that Paul Casey went through quite a rough spell as a professional golfer.
Yep, for sure.
And I just seen him, watched him recently, and carries himself really well, doesn't make a lot of noise, just goes about his profession. And I think, you know, maybe, I don't think he's won a major, but honestly, chapeau. You know, this guy has really done himself proud in his chosen profession.
No, I agree. A good friend of mine in New Jersey is mates with Paul, and he said he's just a fantastic guy. And he, again, you know, on that final round, he was close. Morikawa
played really
hit that
shot, he was even.
He was level with him, and Casey was on the next tee. And so he looked back and saw the shot, and you saw him just smile looking at the shot. He didn't know he'd hit it, and they interviewed him when he came off the 18th green. And again, a remarkable interview. You know, he just said, look, you know, I got no complaints. I played great this week. When you see a shot like that, you just have to tip your hat. And you know, I got beaten. I didn't lose. And, you know, this kid played remarkable golf. I mean, it's just, I don't know what it is. There's something about golf, Rog, that fosters this kind of ability to be authentic and to be respectful and to appreciate competition. And I don't know whether that is because it's essentially an individual game. There's no team. There's no, so it is all about you. You, 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 I guess you have to be aware of who you are and what you stand for and stuff, and you're out there very much on your own. But it was, again, you know, just there's plenty. Golf has scored plenty of goals these last couple of weeks, and yeah. You know, Morikawa and Casey were two more of those.
Yeah. Listen, how about we wind this up with a couple of stories that link with previous guests a little bit and in the world of sport and finance, because I think they're important. The first one I'd like to mention, which is getting a lot of coverage now also in the FT, is the amazing story of the Mets, your famous Mets.
Ah, yes. The Amazons.
Yeah, the Amazons. We talked about it with Jerry Cardinale. We talked about it a couple of times as America's pastime. And what's clear here, baseball, I don't think, as they say, the economics of the sport are particularly rosy going forward. But God, that's not stopping anybody, is it? You know, like, they're all wanting this. And, you know, you just reflect, this is the ultimate, scorecard in American life. You know, there was an episode of the Billions where, you know, Bobby Axelrod was trying to buy a sports franchise, and they were saying, you know, that this is only royalty get to buy a sports franchise. And I guess that's why you've got everybody trying to buy the Mets. And, you know, and that includes...
Well, I mean, look, the Mets are, if you think of it in football terms for us, the Mets are Man City, right? I mean, you've got the Yankees in the same town who are the behemoth, no matter which way you look at it, whether they're playing well or badly. The Yankees are the crown jewel of Major League Baseball. They just are. They're a global brand, just like Manchester United are. Can you buy the Mets and have that New York cachet and turn them into a winning team like they did with Man City? I mean, that's the dream, right? Because at the end of the day, if you can turn them into a successful team, you're in New York, and it's for many people the center of the world. So that it's something that many people have tried to do. And I've been a Mets fan for 25, 30 years, right? So I know the pain that that whoever gets up by them is going to go through. But can they do it? And it's a tantalizing prospect.
Well, you see, I know that's the metaphor, but I actually don't think it's necessarily about them becoming a successful team. What I'm saying is the ownership of a sports franchise is now the ultimate bragging rights. It puts you into a pantheon of American society and achievement that trumps, you know, super yachts and private jets. And, you know, 100 billion net worths owning a sports franchise. And that's why I find this so interesting, as I said to Jerry Cardinale at the time, where I don't think the numbers justify it in terms of a business valuation. But these numbers are going through the roof, and they just, you know, I think that's one of the stories of this year, that notwithstanding how fucked sport is economically, owning a sports franchise, particularly in the States, is still the thing to have.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, you're right. It's been that way for a while, but it seems to be picking up speed now. And, you know, we could speculate from an economic standpoint as to why that is, and we can speculate as to the reasons why there's so much money being thrown at sports franchises, but I think that's a conversation for a different podcast.
Well, let's segue then into the second one I was going to mention, which is your mate. Again, we've talked about it various times, Jim Pallotta. This week, probably today, as we're speaking on Monday, the final closing contracts will be signed with Friedkin, and he will sell Roma. And you know better than anybody his rationale for buying it, which was a little bit like the rationale you explained there for the Mets. However, it has been an unmitigated disaster, culminating in Jim Pallotta now being sued in America by his minority stakeholders, who think that the structure of the sale is benefiting him and prejudicing the minority shareholding rights. if you were sitting here with Jim now and remembering your conversation at the time he was about to buy it, what would you be saying to him, Grant?
Well, I definitely wouldn't be saying I told you so, if that's what you're looking for. Because I definitely wouldn't be saying that, because, you know, he thought it was a great bit of business. He thought there was a crown jewel there that needed polishing, and if he could do that, he would end up with something really, really important. And look, he was right. Had he been successful in all those things, he was absolutely right. And for a time, it looked like he was going to be, right? I mean, Roma performed very well. He was being carried through the streets of Rome by fans and lauded left and right. But it brings us back to that fickle nature of football. What have you done for me lately? You may have got to the semifinals of the Champions League last year, and you may have, come that close to winning the Scudetto, but you didn't. And this year, we're not even in with a shout, and so, we've got no time for you. That's just the nature of the beast. My point to him when we first had this conversation was, I said, aren't these football clubs just vanity projects? Why do people want to buy them? It just seems the wage structure and stuff are such that it just doesn't seem sensible to me. Now, the success that the Fenway Sports Group have had with Liverpool would belie what I said to Jim, and he was that close. But what I didn't take into account, which is something that you would know much more about, and that's doing business in Italy, which is a whole different level, it seems, from what I've read about the story and how I followed it over the years. It seems that is a whole different layer of aggravation that is unlike anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, well, it's not necessarily aggravation. It's a different ball game, pun intended. And not just in sport. If one were to be superficial and stereotype things, and German business is all about process and clear lines of whatever, operating in Italy and especially in Rome is all about EQ, the management of human frailty and the management of the seven deadly sins, and how you manipulate people's weakness to your benefit. I wrote an article about what Rome is, and I do believe this. I've studied it enough, I've been around enough Romans. I genuinely think that Rome, because they had such dominance and excellence so early, I'm talking 2000 years ago, I think they got bored with the whole achievement and success thing.
Well, like I said, Rod, what have you done for me lately?
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is that's why it's a mismatch. Romans care about different things than being number one, because they did the number one thing. They did it better than anybody will ever do it. Any empire since then has been a pale imitation of the Roman Empire in terms of achievement. So you go to a city like Rome and you take out the Roman DNA that is so important, the Rossi Totti and everything like that, you don't understand that their buttons are completely different, and you throw out the American sports franchise playbook, of course it's going to fail, I think Friedkin, I don't know who he is, I'd never heard of him before of this, I'm sure he's a hugely successful and impressive family, I don't know them, but I'm telling you, unless you understand that Rome is the center of Byzantine, Machiavellian, medieval type thinking, then you will not succeed. You need to play a really different playbook in that city.
Yeah, well, I defer to you completely on this, because I don't know. I mean, I've watched it all unravel with great sadness, I have to say, because Jim's intentions were beyond pure. I mean, he really wanted to make this thing a success, and he grew to absolutely love it. He wasn't a football fan necessarily before this, but having spoken to him, I mean, this thing really got into his heart and under his skin. I mean, both the place and the club and the team and the city and all that stuff. I mean, it really, really got to him. So I know he will be devastated at the way this has turned out. Absolutely devastated.
Yeah. Too bad.
Listen, we can't close, actually, Rog, without a little word about Ronnie.
Oh, yes.
Now, we can't possibly. Now, Ronnie O'Sullivan wins the World Snooker Championship for the sixth time yesterday.
Sorry, we just have to explain to people that haven't heard Hugh Henry yet, the episode. We did set up who Ronnie O'Sullivan was to Hugh Henry. And, you know, the context is everything, that Ronnie is not your normal sports person.
He is not your normal sports person. He is anything but your normal sports person. But, you know, universally acknowledged as the most talented snooker player of all time. Everybody, from the Steve Davises of the world to the Stephen Hendrys of the world, who are...
Even Hendry, you know, says it, does he?
Yeah, yeah. They all say that he is the greatest to ever hold a cue. But look, he has his demons, right? And he's had highs, he's had lows. He comes from an extraordinary family background. I mean, if you don't know Ronnie O'Sullivan's story, then Google it and look at what he's done. I mean, they showed some clips before the final, and I hadn't even realized this because, you know, there was a period when I was, I guess, in the US where I just didn't see any snooker. It's not a particularly big sport over in America, but he had a 5:20 147 in a tournament. Now, yep. just think about that for a moment. The cavalier attitude to take 5 minutes to clear a snooker table for a maximum break. Well, you know, in this same program, they showed clips of, and I remember the first live 147 at the World Championships, the Cliff Thorburn in 1980. Yep. I remember watching that.
Yeah, we all did, yep.
And it felt like he took 5 minutes over that final black just to compose himself. And you know, and I'll never forget. I remember exactly where I was. I remember the whole thing. It was bizarre. But to make a 147 break in 5 minutes and 20 odd seconds is just, it just staggered me when I heard that, Rog. I mean, and you know, so Ronnie gets into the final. He comes out the first session firing, just walking away with the final. And after the first session ended, I think he was 6-2 ahead.
Yeah.
And Stephen Hendry said, "This is over." And you could, I mean, he said, "This is over. It's done." And the other commentators were kind of, I guess, trying to keep people around to watch the rest of it. They said, "Well, you know, he could come back." Hendry said, "No, this is over." The next session, you get the other Ronnie O'Sullivan, and he's missing balls, frankly, that I could pop. I mean, it was bizarre to watch. And Kyron Wilson, who again is a fine young man, gets it back to, I think, 10-8 maybe. I think it was within two at one point. I think it was back to 10-8.
Yeah.
And then the next morning, Sullivan, he just says, "All right, enough of this." And just, I think, demolishes him 8-1 in a session and takes himself to one frame from victory. So they go back for the evening session and he needs one frame. It takes him 20 minutes and he wins it. But it was the highs, the lows, the demons, it was all there. And Ronnie O'Sullivan is not just a generational talent. He's a historical talent.
Yeah, they broke them all there.
He did. But he's everything that
everything that
great sports stars are, right? He's talent, he's conflict, it was remarkable. And so it was so great to see him win that. But say, you know, Kyron Wilson, again, dignified in defeat, a really fine young man.
I think he was overawed. I think, you know...
I think you're right.
And, you know, like, I'm playing my idol. He probably watched Ronnie growing up. And then you're playing the World Championship final against him. I really felt sorry for the lad, I must admit. Even though I was certainly rooting for Ronnie. The funny thing, Grant, is that I was in Scotland last week and I spent some time with my dad and my son was there. So there was the three of us there and we were watching the snooker against Selby, you know, the semi-final.
Yeah, yeah.
And as is often the case with my father, he doesn't like the flash ones. So right. He doesn't like Ronnie. He likes, you know, the people that do it proper and like grind it out.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And you know, so he obviously, this is the story of my life, really. He takes Selby. And, you know, my son's a little bit like me, actually worse than me. You know, he just, from his generation, he wants the talent, you know. Yeah. And if you're not the talent, I'm not even tuning in, you know, type thing. So my dad was 2-1. And, you know, he's getting on a bit now. So as folks get older, they get a wee bit ratty, you know. And so you can imagine, you know, so Ronnie in this period's in his pomp in this period in the semi-final. And I start having a go at him. I start saying, "Look at that Selby. You know, if all snooker players were like him, this fucking sport wouldn't be on the TV. You know, you realize that, don't you? You know, we're only watching this on TV because there's people that want to see Ronnie. And look at it. Look at it. It's glorious. And he comes out. His dad's a murderer. You know, it's going to stop. And I tell you, we had a back and forward. It was so funny, Grant.
You need to record this stuff, Rog. You need to record it. You really do.
Yeah, well, exactly. For more than one reason, to be honest. But anyway, I do need to record that. It's great fun.
Great fun. You know, for anyone listening who is a snooker fan, and if you have access to the BBC iPlayer, whether you live in Britain or you happen to understand how a VPN works, I don't know. That's entirely up to you. But there's a show on the BBC iPlayer, 40 Years of the Crucible, which is the place where the world champion snooker is held. And Rog, if you haven't seen this, and you used to watch snooker in the 80s, when, you know, in the 90s and its heyday, I promise you, you have to find this. Steve Davis goes back to the Crucible and talks about the history of it, talks with all the players. If it doesn't bring a tear to your eye, I'd be amazed. It was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
I bet it was. Great.
All right. Well, I reckon that's us.
Thanks for that chat, Grant.
We are just about out of goals and own goals, but rest assured, thanks to the nature of sport, there'll be plenty more next time we get together. So all that remains, as always, is to thank you for listening. To ask you if you wouldn't mind rating and reviewing us in the iTunes store. That would really, really help
us. I'm not sure that's going to help anymore, coming back to the start. I'm sure we've got a whole lot of one ratings now.
Well, you have, Rog, you have. There's nothing we can do about that now. We just have to grasp the nettle and move forward.
Please
follow us on Twitter, or unfollow Roger. Follow us at EntertainedR, that's the word A-R-E. And you can follow me at TTMYGH.
And if you still want to, you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Rog, I still love you. I'll see you soon.
Thank you. Take care, Grant. Bye-bye.